again, and thanks for listening to On the Page. This is the podcast that accompanies the Writers' Festival of Belgium. I'm Alia Papageorgiou, and this is our 2026 season, kicking off with a Brussels-based author and longtime journalist. You're going to be listening to a conversation I had with Dave Keating on his book, The Owned Continent, looking at Europe from originally from the US perspective, but calls himself an adopted European, as you'll hear. So free-ranging conversation, but very focused on his book, how he got it published, how it's going, and the impact of some of his ideas written in the book about what he supposes could overcome this apparent ownership that the US has over Europe. Let us know what you think and enjoy. We're very lucky to have you with us to talk about your book, which I'm so excited about. But how are you finding it? How are you doing?
Good.
Are you getting any sleep?
What I've found is that book promotion is a full-time job, really.
Tell us a bit about the book.
Yeah, The book came out in December. It's called The Owned Continent, right. How to Free Europe from American Military, Economic, and Cultural Dependence. I had the idea for it last year. I wrote a Substack post when Trump was threatening tariffs on movie imports to the U.S., 100% tariffs, and I thought that was kind of bizarre because Americans don't watch any foreign movies. He was really thinking of the American movies that are shooting outside the U.S. Anyway, that kind of fizzled and went nowhere. But I wrote a Substack saying, why don't we think about doing that? Why don't we put tariffs on American imports of American movies and television and music?
From Europe, you mean?
Yeah, from on Europe's end. And I went through the statistics about just how dominated Europe is culturally. And people were really surprised by those statistics. So I thought this would be an interesting subject to explore more.
Yeah.
And then I thought, but I want it to be wider than that because I want to make a kind of a treatise of why I think that American cultural dominance isn't just an interesting detail, but is actually really throwing Europe into inertia right now, how you can connect the surrender of European leaders during 2025 to this cultural dominance that exists here and that it has fostered this kind of attitude of servility. So in the book, the first section, I start with a prologue where I explain, even though I'm American, why I am kind of an adopted European, explaining to people where I'm coming from in the prologue. Then a section on the cultural dominance, a section on the economic dominance, a section on the military dominance, and then a final section with six essential steps to liberate Europe from the United States. I wrote the book last summer mostly, and then in the autumn was the editing process, and then it was published in December, coincidentally just 3 days after the U.S. National Security Strategy came out.
You just said you wrote it in 3 months.
Less, really, yeah.
Less than 3 months.
Yeah, so I actually...
How did you do that?
It was the Substack. The Substack helped that.
Really?
I have tried to write books twice before in my life and given up.
Once, this we have to hear about.
Yeah, one was going to be looking at how different European countries teach EU civics. And I started working on that, and it was going to be requiring a lot of research.
Right.
And I just didn't have the bandwidth to do it properly. So I gave up on that. And then another one was a history of EU crisis. I was started writing that in 2016. I wrote 150 pages. But I don't know.
It's
I just
crisis
kind of
can help us do things, Dave. Sorry.
Well,
But not this one.
I'm working on this as my next book. So I'll try to finish that book that I started back in 2016.
Great.
Obviously,
news.
I have to add new crises. So yeah. At the time, it was all the crises up to 2016. So what made the difference this time is having written the Substack for 3 years at that point, I was able to go to all my posts and kind of draw from those. So I had already done a lot of research for all the posts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to avoid the writer's block by going back, looking at a Substack post and saying, okay, this is going to be the basis of this chapter. And it was so helpful in actually getting me to write. So basically during the month of August, I would get up at 8 and just write for 8 hours every day.
That's amazing.
Was really disciplined about it and had it mostly done by like the mid-September.
Right. Amazing in my mind because I've been dealing with fiction and it's like I'm still stuck on an idea from 5 years ago. But it's different when you have it. That's amazing. That's amazing. Congratulations.
I think it was
that's
also
so
I
good.
was so
but it was
angered by President von der Leyen's appearance in Scotland, yeah. where she signed that surrender deal. And I started writing the book the next day after that, actually.
That
so
it was golf trip.
Yeah, it was kind of a cathartic, like almost like therapeutic exercise to write the book, because I was so frustrated with European leaders. Yeah. And so writing the book helped me do something with that frustration.
So this felt more like energized, this anger, this passion, this like, this has to happen. Whereas the other two kind of, you got busy with everyday work.
Yeah, exactly. And they were kind of retrospective. So yeah, it wasn't,
this was
the
like
passion
hot
wasn't
on
there.
The iron's hot. What do most people say when you say surrender? Like, it sounds like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? We haven't surrendered.
I got pushback from a lot of people like on the left, like anti-Trump people, saying that's an exaggeration. This wasn't a surrender. This is a two-way deal. Mm-hmm. Like people on Blue Sky, and they were defending the deal on behalf of the EU. Yeah, right. I have a lot to say about Blue Sky, but let's not go into that.
Okay.
So I was getting a lot of pushback on the idea that the EU had surrendered. Mm-hmm. By the autumn, that deal did not really have any more defenders. Right, it had become clear that not only was the US not abiding by its part of the deal. So then the argument that the pushback became, okay, yes, the EU, the deal was not a real free trade deal. It was a series of concessions, but we had to make them to save Ukraine.
Right.
So that kind of became the narrative. Like, that's why European leaders were surrendering in 2025 to protect Ukraine and to maintain America's protection over Europe in case of a Russian invasion. But I really don't think that holds up anymore either, because Donald Trump has pulled almost all support for Ukraine already.
Yeah.
So clearly it didn't work. The only thing the U.S. is still providing is intelligence cooperation.
Right.
That's why we're having this 90 billion euro loan for Ukraine. I feel like every news article about this should point this out. The money has to come because it has to replace the American support that was pulled. And then, you know, also more information has come up out about the energy promises of that deal, the $1.35 trillion of European investment that's been promised into the U.S. economy. People have also seen the omnibus proposals, which are basically implementing what the EU implicitly promised, that they would allow the U.S. to rewrite European legislation, or that they would rewrite European legislation to the benefit of America. So I think nobody denies now that that was a one-way, you know, concession deal.
Yeah.
But the pushback I get is, but we have no choice. We have to do it.
Right.
But, I mean, for what? Like I say, Donald Trump has already abandoned Ukraine.
Right.
And there is no NATO anymore. I mean, let's get real. It's a paper tiger because only one man decides whether it's a paper tiger or not. And that's Donald Trump. And he says it is. So we should believe him.
Yeah.
So what has all this surrendering got in Europe in the end? I do think that since the book came out in December, there's a greater realization of this because of Greenland and because of Iran. Europeans are maybe finally starting to wake up and also think that they can't keep pursuing this strategy of subservience and surrender.
And armed, has that been? What has been the reaction to
Yeah,
that?
I mean, it's
oh,
a
continent.
It's a deliberately provocative word. So the French edition is coming out in 1 month.
What is it called?
Le continent captif, the captive continent. Lots of alliteration there. You know, we'll see how that word compares with the owned word. Obviously, in English, owned is supposed to evoke old. So Europe being referred to the old continent. So owned, it's kind of brings to mind that phrase of the old continent. But the you know, I stand by the word. I mean, and I haven't gotten big pushback from it. Interestingly, the number one thing I've gotten pushback for in the book is what I say about language, pointing out that English is now Europe's lingua franca, spoken by more than half of EU citizens.
But okay.
Well, I mean, it is. It's, it's the most. It's
I don't
the
know,
first time.
Trop loin.
It's French is third in every category in terms of the degree to which it's spoken.
Obliterated. Sorry.
I mean, now we have more than half of EU citizens
post-Brexit
being able to comfortably speak in English.
Sure.
That's only 2% of those are native speakers in Ireland.
Right.
So it for the first time, Europe has a lingua franca that everyone, that common people can speak, because previous lingua francas, like French, were just used by business and political elites.
Mm-hmm.
And we should harness that, I make the argument in the book. But people really don't like this idea. You can imagine which countries push back on this the most.
No, but I mean, like in general, why do you think that you just think it's just the numbers, just that there's so many people that actually know English.
It's not like practical, really. I mean, maybe with AI, we'll get to a point where we can all have little machines in our ears. I don't think we're nearly there. I mean, I'm not sure we're going to get to a point where we all have automatic translators in our ears.
I don't know about our ears, but at least on our screens.
I mean, we know here in Brussels, English is absolutely the lingua franca of the European Union. All conferences are in English.
Sure, the conferences are.
When MEPs speak to each other in trilogues, they're speaking English. When people at the commission are speaking to each other.
German is pretty standard from what I've seen. But it's an interesting hobby horse for you.
No EU policy events in French or German.
No, but they're all in English. Translated if you need to.
But most conference organizers would never do that. It's extremely expensive. The only time they do it is if you have like a French minister who's forbidden from speaking English.
Right. It's interesting.
So I think we just need to acknowledge reality. We can't be fooling ourselves about the current situation, even if it might hurt people's national pride. Yeah. That is the situation.
Yeah. There is a whole conversation about nationalism and...
In Europe, language has been very tied to nationhood. Yeah. That's something quite unique to Europe, we should always remember. Because, you know, it's only Europe that thinks that every language deserves its own country. Well, clearly, language is a very emotive topic for people. Yeah. And I've just found it interesting that this is... I'm not even calling for anything, really. I'm just asking people to acknowledge the reality that English is the lingua franca. But even that... you know, at every launch event, every book reading I've done, this turns into a big tangent.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not really central to the book in any way. But it's like the only thing that people disagree on tends to be. I mean, people are like, EU army. Yeah, I mean, all these things that I thought would be very controversial are not. But in this crisis. Language thing which, I mean, that has surprised
me. That's interesting. What I think is really interesting is the entertainment movie part that you bring into the book, because I don't see a lot of conversation on that, economic conversation around movies. Talk a bit about that, what you put in the book in terms of, or was it just about the tariff that you mentioned?
So, I mean, I trace the advent of Hollywood's domination over Europe starting in the 1920s.
Which I think is brilliant. Yeah, I don't see that often. Or do you see it in the US movies with people writing about this?
No, this is a very unexplored topic.
So the
movie dominance starts in the 1920s, right after World War I, because the European movie studios were decimated, and so the American studios swept in, partially with the help of the State Department. This was a coordinated effort. Then you have the dominance of American television starting in the American music starting in the 1960s, American television starting in the 1980s, American internet starting in the late 90s, 2000s, and social media obviously coming from there.
Yeah.
And that connects to a dominance of American news media, which sets the European narrative, which I explore in the book. So this wasn't all at once. And it's kind of, if you think about it, it's not a deal that Europeans would have like signed up to if you asked them, like, do you want to be dominated in all facets of your life by this external superpower? It was like, they were like frogs in boiling water. This came over decades. And all of a sudden, Europeans like stop and look around and they're like, everything around me is American. When I use my phone is American. I go on a computer, I'm using a Microsoft operating system. I go to the store and I'm paying with American credit cards. I turn on the TV and almost certainly I'm going to find American TV show. I turn on the radio, I'm going to find American music. People didn't ask for this. They didn't want it, but it just kind of came over decades. And I think that has led to this psychology of subservience, because Europeans almost start to feel subconsciously like they're in America, or at least in the outer colonies of America. And that makes it very hard to acknowledge that America could be an adversary or even an enemy. And that's, we've seen this denialism in Europe over the past year about what America has become. Particularly from our centrist leaders who are just gaslighting Europeans that everything's normal and America is still a great ally and still a great friend. Again, I think that's starting to change, but it came from somewhere. It came from a psychology, because as I write in the book, if you had the leader of China behaving the way Donald Trump has, treating Europe the way Donald Trump has, Europeans would never have accepted it. Can you imagine President Xi doing all the things to Europe that President Trump has, all the threats, all the insults, and having European leaders groveling to President Xi and flying over there to Beijing and giving him gifts. And European citizens would be revolting, right? They would be furious. But European citizens have accepted this behavior of their leaders when it comes to America. And that's because America is like a parent in this continent. It's considered something that can't be harmful, even when you see it harming you. And in the book, I make the analogy of a child with an abusive parent, that the parent has been like the only thing they know their whole lives. And so it's too scary to try to push back. And you also start to make excuses for yourself for the parent.
No, I think it's super interesting. I mean, you can also say that there's always this idea that Hollywood knows how to produce a better show.
Well, this idea that like Hollywood does it better.
Yeah, exactly.
And as I go through in the book, that's not the case. What it is that America had the market size, and that you had it's a single market question. That Europe didn't have a single market for movies because it's splintered into different languages.
Yeah.
And America did have the single market for movies, so you get the massive investment in big budget movies that then are able to export. And so in the book, I explore some ways that we could do that as Europe, because the role that European movie producers put themselves in starting in the 1950s was that they would make better quality things, that they would make artistic films. Sure. And so that's been the role of Europe for the past decade.
Yeah, that's where film came from, you know, in France. And there is the quality versus kind of quantity and glitz. But there's also this kind of everything is, you know, normal and it's okay to keep relying on America because we'll always come and save you. But that wasn't the case. I think that's how you were.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's a conversation Europe should have had in the 1990s at the end of the Cold War. And instead, there was this kind of attitude that, okay, we'll extend NATO over to the east. We'll keep everything as it is. And America will always be there and not ever object to like having to protect us. And the writing has been on the wall for a very, very long time. The Obama administration was lecturing Europeans about this. This didn't come out of nowhere. It's just the Europeans didn't want to listen.
I think you were there that day too.
Yes,
I
was
there. Yeah, I remember that. So tell us about the six things of what Europe has to do, if you don't mind.
Sure.
If it's captured in a nutshell or not.
So in the book, I say that several things are really necessary to have an independent Europe. And number one is a federal Europe. I am a federalist, and no one has ever told me any convincing way that Europe can be sovereign and independent without federalism. How individual nation states in an intergovernmental community could ever be able to retain their own sovereignty and not fall under the influence of either Russia or the United States. I just don't think there's any other way. So I believe strongly in federalism. I think we need treaty change very urgently, but there's also many things we can do to act before we have treaty change. And one of the main things we need to do is dilute the power of the Council, of the EU Council, which is both the most powerful EU institution and the least transparent, the most unknown by citizens, the most democratically unaccountable. And really, that the problem is citizens have no idea what the council is. And that leads me to my other recommendation. The fatal flaw here is that Europeans are not taught what the EU is. There is no civics education for their confederal level of government. And that is a big, big problem. How can you expect European citizens to participate in EU democracy when they're taught literally nothing about it? I mean, I'm talking literally nothing, right? They don't even know the basics. 50% of Europeans graduate secondary school not knowing that they have directly elected representatives in the European Parliament. The vast majority of people have never heard of the EU Council, which would be like an American not knowing the Senate or a German not knowing the Bundesrat. So there's a big, big problem there, and we have to solve that. Interestingly, I note in the book that Eastern EU countries are the only ones that do teach EU civics, but it's very generational because they started teaching it in 2000 in preparation for the accession that came in 2004. And so people have asked me, well, but some of the disapproval of the EU is highest in those Eastern states. You think about Hungary and Poland. And I say, yeah, but that's the most generational divide that exists on the question of EU approval. So in Western Europe, whether you like or dislike the EU, doesn't really have an age. Right. Like younger people tend to be more in favor and younger people, older people tend to be less in favor. But the difference isn't as stark as in the Eastern EU, where it's a, you see a clear, clear divide between people who went to school after the year 2000. So even I went to high school before the year 2000. So Eastern Europeans my age and above, you see that they didn't get this education about what the EU is. And so their disapproval of the EU, or let's say even disinformation about the EU is much higher. Okay. So we have to educate Europeans. We do have to do something to foster a less American European culture, because I say, you know, Europe does have a pan-European culture right now. It's called American culture. The culture that Europeans bond over, they don't know anything about each other's pop stars or each other's TV shows, but they all know American TV shows and American pop stars. And that's what they can come together to talk about. I hear it in, here in Brussels all the time. If an Italian is talking to a German, they're not going to talk about their domestic pop stars. They're going to be talking about Beyonce. So we have to be able to establish a common European culture that is not American. That's where I make those recommendations about language, which have proven unpopular, but I'm sticking by them. So then some other recommendations are, I call for an EU army, which I think the furthest we can go on that is probably something like the U.S. National Guard, where each state in the U.S. has its own military under the control of the governor, which is then operated federally under an American command and control structure. I think that's what we should be aiming for in the EU. And I think we need that urgently for obvious reasons. And then lastly, I say that Europeans need to believe in themselves. We need to give Europeans a confidence to understand that America's not always better. Stop dreaming of living in America. Start understanding that you have it great in Europe. I mean, this is a fantastic place to live, with all the social benefits that we know here in Europe, but also it's a continent with a rich, rich history that Europeans should not be squeamish about being proud of. They should be fully cognizant of all the mistakes that this continent has made, and there have been many over centuries, but also they should be proud of what Europe has accomplished, and they should have some confidence, because that's what gives Americans the edge, is that we're taught to be so overconfident from childhood. And I sense that in European education systems, they're really, Europeans are taught to doubt themselves. They're taught to question themselves and
themselves
be meek.
Or everything around them, or because of the circumstances, maybe wars, yeah. Or
no, I really
civil
think themselves,
or,
because I think Americans are taught to question the world around them also. No, I think they're taught to doubt themselves.
It's
also about how European education systems have such an emphasis on testing, whereas American education systems have an emphasis on class participation and essay writing and this type of thing. I think that alone, I think that a test-based education system does not engender confidence or creativity.
So you have been here since 2010 in Brussels.
I've been in Brussels since 2010. I was in London before that.
Are you in London? I was just going to say, but aren't you surprised at how far the EU has come?
Okay. If you look at the years 2010 to 2025, and compare them with the years 1990 to 2010, I mean, it's night and day difference in terms of EU progress. I mean, the EU, until 2005, until the rejection of the EU constitution by French and Dutch voters, the EU was making huge, huge strides toward ever closer union and federalism, and that rejection put the brakes on that. And we saw that, yes, the Lisbon Treaty was adopted, went through in 2009, and then there was no appetite for big leaps and bounds after that. We got band-aid solutions to the economic crisis, to the COVID crisis. Each time there was a crisis, the leaders would do kind of the bare minimum necessary to keep things afloat. I mean, that's Angela Merkel's doing. So I don't see this period that I've been in Brussels as being a time of great progress. I see this as being a time of stasis. This is really what the new book is going to be about, that it's been a time of crisis and mostly stasis and band-aid solutions to those crises. I mean, you have the European semester, you have new things that are trying to coordinate European budgetary movements, but they haven't been done in a cohesive way. And, you know, we see the Commission really ignoring the European semester rules and things. So I don't see the EU as having made great strides in the time that I've been here.
Does that mean that that crisis, that next book with on crisis and stasis is more about how the Council could not be? the most important?
Oh, yes.
Is it like advice on
what to
do with the council?
The problem is obviously, in an ideal world, yeah. and I quote a lot the former Dutch MEP, Sophie Intervelt, who spoke right. at my book launch. She wrote a whole book about the council called The Scent of Wild Animals, and she really goes through the problems with the council and why it needs to be reformed. But the problem is that the people who decide whether or not in order to dilute the power of the council has to say yes,
right.
unanimously. Right. So it's a huge hurdle, and I don't deny that. Right. But if we're really thinking long term about the European Union and making Europe sovereign and independent, the national leaders need to stop being so selfish, need to stop thinking so short term, and think about the long term vision for their country. Very hard to get 27 leaders to think of that at the same time. But
exactly. Tell us a little bit about the process of publishing. How you handled that? What did you think of that?
It was definitely a learning experience because it's my first book.
Yeah.
So I wrote it first, then took it to publishers circa September. If you write a book in English in Europe, it's going to be British publishers. I was talking to British publishers. I just felt like they didn't get it.
Yeah.
But the biggest problem is there were a couple that were interested, but they were talking about timelines of like a year and a half. They were talking about late 2026, 2027. I said, no, I need this. Like, this has to come out now. It's about current events.
Yeah.
I mean, even now doing the French book, I'm having to update things that happened in the past 3 months, and it feels like 3 years.
Yeah.
So I also had a literary agent, and I said, you know, honestly, is there any publisher that could get this out? I said, latest I'm willing to wait is like April of 2026. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, you should self-publish if you want that. So I did self-publish the English book. So the decision I made is that I would self-publish the English book and then find publishers for the other languages.
Okay.
So now I have a publisher for the French book. Shortly should have something to announce about an Italian publisher. I would not have thought Italian would come before German, but it did.
That's amazing. That's so good.
Yeah, so that...
You have no idea how difficult it is for everyone, for, like, you know, definitely in fiction, I would say. Maybe not so much for non, but it depends on the topic, of course.
Yeah, I felt that...
It's so difficult.
I'm glad I made the decision I did, because obviously it was very important that it came out when it did.
That impetus of, like, this is when I want it, this is how... That's like such a driver.
Maybe it's the American thing.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
But I mean, also, I think
that's
that...
school system.
I mean, I will say it's monetarily much more interesting. You keep, obviously, way more of the profit when you are self-published.
Right.
And I felt that I had the reach in Brussels to be able to promote this myself.
Yeah.
But another reason for doing the editions in France and Germany and Italy with publishers is because I don't have a reach in France or Germany or Italy, right?
Right.
So there, I don't have the name recognition that I have here in Brussels.
Sure.
So I felt like, okay, I can do this myself for Brussels.
Yeah.
And then have publishers help me reach outside of the bubble.
Okay.
I actually will say the book has reached much more outside the bubble than I was expecting. And I've been doing readings outside Brussels.
Yeah.
And the sales, I've particularly had a lot of sales in the U.S., which is interesting. Like, this book is not for them at all,
but if they want
to read it, great.
Well, if it's there, it's there. I think
actually I understand why that's happening, because Americans really have, regular American citizens, have no idea how much they control the world. When you grow up in America, it's like you're a fish in a fishbowl. Everyone is looking in at you, but you can't see out, because we don't see anything from the outside world. The fundamental problem is America is a very isolated country, and I can speak on that from experience growing up there. It's like the rest of the world does not exist, and yet the rest of the world, and in particular Europe, is entrusting these Americans to make electoral decisions every 4 years that determines their global leadership. I mean, basically, Europeans cede it to American voters to select who will be the president of Europe. Donald Trump joked that, European leaders tell me I'm the president of Europe. Right. I think I have a pretty clear idea who told him that. It was probably Mark Rutte. But he wasn't really joking. And in a way, he is. In a way, you know, who is elected the president of the United States has a huge impact on Europeans, and not just because the U.S. is a big country, but also because they allow themselves to be ruled by the United States.
Yeah.
And entrusting that responsibility to people who wouldn't be able to find Belgium on a map, the average American voter, is just ridiculous.
Just on the point of journalism in Brussels and how things have happened since maybe 2010, in terms of working in journalism, in terms of say if your young journalists come to Brussels today, what would you tell them?
It's definitely a much more, it's a much more dynamic.
To survive.
Well, it's a much more dynamic and developed media ecosystem than the one that existed here when I arrived.
Right.
I mean, Brussels news was really very ignored.
Right.
I mean, I mentioned I went to London first. It was always with the intent as a stopover till I came to Brussels.
Right.
And when I told people in London I wanted to go to Brussels to be a journalist to cover the EU, they were like, what? They thought it was like the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
I remember when I moved to Brussels, I had a time out guide to the city. And in the description of the EU quarter, they talked about the residence palace. And they said, that's where the journalists are based. Right. A purgatorial assignment, they called it. So it was really like not considered something sexy, not considered something interesting. And I will say, Politico changed the game on
that's what everybody asked me to
do. And it's very unfortunate that
it
took an American
landscape.
Company to come in and do that. You know, I think there were companies that had publications here, a British company, that did not understand the asset that it had.
Right.
And so, you know, European companies were not interested in investing in Brussels journalism, and it took an American company to do that. And that's disgraceful.
Mm-hmm.
A European should be really embarrassed by that. So, yeah, the ecosystem has developed. You know, it is still hard to get to report on EU news in a way that everybody pays attention to outside Brussels, largely because they don't have this base of information about what the EU is and how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to translate that, even for editors. I mean, even like national newspaper editors don't know how the EU works. So even when you're a Brussels correspondent and you're filing a story, it's even hard to make your editor understand it.
Yeah,
so it's a big challenge still, but definitely Brussels journalism has become much more developed and much sexier since I first arrived.
Okay, fantastic. Wait, I was going to ask you about, so the French translation, you're working with the translator or you're...
The publisher does the translation.
Does everything.
So I have two chapters left to review. So they basically send me the translation, I review it, make sure it's still what I wanted to say.
Done.
Yeah.
You have to tell me when it comes out.
Tentative publication date June 4th.
Oh, okay. You have a date. That's amazing. Brilliant. That's so great. And what's like one of your favorite books of all time that you would? Could be anything.
It doesn't really answer the question, but I will say the book that inspired me to move to Europe was Jeremy Rifkin's The European Dream, which was written in 2004. And it really gave me it inspired me to move to Europe to see the potential of the EU. And even though I think he was describing an EU maybe that we wish existed but didn't exist yet at that point and still doesn't now, I still have never given up a hope that the world that Rifkin was describing, where the EU can be a sovereign, independent power, standing astride next to Russia, United States, and China in the 21st century. I've never given up on the hope that that is achievable.
So that was Dave Keating, long-term journalist, moderator, and author of The Owned Continent, out now. Thank you for joining us again. This year, the festival will be happening October 3rd and 4th in Antwerp. If you're interested to be involved or have any ideas for further conversations here on the podcast or live during the festival, please don't hesitate to reach out to us at info@riotfest.be. Our website is riotfest.be. This podcast is produced by Mr. Paul McNally, and the music you hear is by the gentle guitar of Mr. Craig Gwinnicker. Have a lovely day and keep writing. Talk to you soon.